All right. Today, I am joined by casting director Caitlin D. Jones, Bagel and Coffee, all there as well. Caitlin, thanks for joining me. Morning. How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm all right. And it always feels like a somber intro when I bring people on now, just because of the state of the world. My go-to question, I think, always has to be like, how have you been personally and professionally in this wacky, well, year?
Well, personally, I've been very lucky in this situation of the world. I haven't been too directly affected, so I do understand the good fortune and privilege that comes with that. Work-wise, I've done commercials sporadically throughout the pandemic, casting wise, but I haven't been on like a show or film for about a year now.
Right.
That's my dog crying because he wants some of my bagels.
So there you go. Really wants some of your bagel.
Really does.
Was the commercials, I'm assuming all the commercials were like people filming them at home, or were any of those actually out in the, I'm going to air quotes, real world, because I don't know what that is anymore?
Well, I've been doing my job 100% remote, and because, like, you know, when you're in casting, you kind of work for yourself / job to job, and I just kind of, like, as a precursor, just up front, be like, I'm not doing anything in person until there's a vaccine. And so I do everything remote right now, which I'm fine with. I miss being in the studio, because most casting people, it's like our favorite part of the job, is like the most creative part.
Really? I thought it was the admin. I thought you guys loved all the paperwork. No, really?
Doesn't love
I know.
Paperwork. With no pictures either.
There you go.
Just words.
Just words and numbers. But the actual shoots though, were they in studio or were they a bit of both?
Earlier on, they were like film at your house with your family. And then the past couple of months, like 2 or 3 months, it's been like in-person shoots for the talent that are more specific type of guidelines, luckily for safety. Like, I won't take a job unless they can give me a thorough in writing explanation of what the onset protocols will be, that I will then release in my breakdown. Right. Because I don't want to be putting anyone in harm's way. We're not curing cancer, we're making commercials. I'm very aware of where we rank on the list of necessary jobs.
Sure.
Trust me, I think everyone is aware of where they fall on that now because of this whole thing. So I want to go the extra mile, because I want to not only just like protect actors and people from getting sick, but I also want to protect the people in the production from getting sick. So it's like that person where it's like, I don't want to be because of any super spreader hotspots.
We got enough of those without any extra help in the world, to be fair. So
I don't want any of those on my conscience. Yeah. So, yeah.
I feel you. I'm sure we can get into that into more detail in terms of the commercial side of casting, and maybe if it's changed at all with this period. I'm guessing it will have with, you know, Zoom and self-tapes and how you feel about that. And we'll dive into that in a moment. But maybe before we can sort of start at the start a little bit, go into, I guess, you know, Caitlin's origin story of how she got into the casting world. Well, you could be. No one would have known until you said that. And now you did. It's kind of like, I'll edit it out. I'll bleep that part out.
It's okay.
But yeah, like how did you get into casting? I mean, I saw you have a background in comedy. You know, did a load of time at Upright Citizens Brigade. So were you initially looking to be more in the performing side and then moved away, or?
Sorry. Yes to all of it. You've done your Googling, I see. Yeah, well, like most people I've met in casting, at some point they had the idea that, well, I'm just going to be an actor, because like you don't, nobody's like dreamed of being a casting director when they grow up, because you don't know what it is. It's not a job that's like out in the ether just so yet. It's
getting there. See? Slowly, very slowly.
We're working on it. All right. Yeah. Working on
it. It is, though, like, you know, it is literally getting a little bit more exposure slowly, you know. People are kind of giving out awards for casting, as they should, and it's getting a bit more recognized.
Yeah, we're working on it. Yeah. Every day a little bit more. Yeah, a few more people.
There you go.
And so most of us start out thinking we want to be actors, and so I guess since we're calling this an origin story, we can go back a little bit. When I was like in high school, I had this friend and I who were the two like resident drama geeks in our high school. And we would do this thing where before auditions for the school plays and musicals, we would have like a fantasy football draft where we would cast the show with two lists. One list would be who should get the parts, and then the other list would be who would get the parts, because that's who the director was going to pick. And I was always right. And then I went to college for musical theater, and I brought my little fantasy football draft with me. And then this was like older drama geeks all in one place with wine. So that was fun. And then we, in order to graduate, were required to get an internship. And I'm from New York City originally, so I wanted to go to a place where I wouldn't have to pay for room and board and I could be close to home. And so I was like deathly afraid of auditioning, like insane phobia around it. Okay. And a very smart professor told me that if you really want to be an actor, you better get real good at auditioning, because for the bulk of your career, you're going to be doing a lot more auditioning than you are
anything
stuff.
What was that like when you say deathly afraid? Was it nerves, anxiety? Because different people have come on that literally have the same sort of start as an actor, and then they usually say like crippling anxiety would kick in and it was just not worth it.
Pretty much. And so I was like, I'm the type of person that really believes in, if you want to demystify something, learn everything you possibly can about it, and then it no longer becomes scary. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I need to learn everything I possibly can about auditioning. So where do I do that? The place where people audition, casting offices. So I went ahead and sent out my little resume looking for an internship to a million offices. And I went to school in upstate New York in Rochester, so 7 hours away, a 45-minute flight. And only one of them called me back for an interview, and it was Liz Lewis casting, but I had to go in person. Like, this was, there was no Zoom or Skype or anything like that. Like, I had to go in person to interview. So I flew down for a few hours to go and interview for this. And they, luckily I didn't waste my money, because they hired me on the spot.
Okay.
And then one of the casting directors who was working there at the time, Erica Pelgon, like really took me under her wing. And some of the other interns were referring to me behind my back as the prodigy child. And I turned, lo and behold, the thing that I was really good at parties with friends is a job that people pay you money for. And I'm already very good at it.
But all the while you were there thinking about, I just want to get as much info as I can to understand how to use this from an accurate.
I genuinely looked at it as learning as much as I possibly could. Okay. I took it very seriously just from the get-go. And like, I was a talented actor and singer. I am not the greatest dancer. I am anatomically pigeon-toed. So I was only going to go so far in musical theater. You know, sopranos who are petite and at the time blonde are a dime a dozen. So I kind of had a lot stacked against me. And it just seemed so difficult to just get like even the little bit of modicum of traction for me in acting. But everything with casting just came to me with ease. Like I was comparatively at that time outstanding. And it's funny because you talked to one of my bosses, former bosses, Richard Hicks.
Okay.
And
yeah.
Him and I, when we were working on The Stand-In, had this conversation because him and I are very much of the similar like vibe and chit-chattiness when we have downtime. And I was like, you know, what really sold me as pursuing casting is like the main thing is that there's a point in my career very quickly where I was getting really exciting casting jobs that I would never get cast in if I was auditioning for them. And he was like, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And it's like, and that's when I figured like, all right, I think the writing's on the wall here. I'm feeling extremely creatively fulfilled. I'm doing more acting and more interacting with actors creatively in a casting room than I ever did as an actor. And I'm a Leo, my star sign. And I'm really good at telling people what to do. And I have this innate ability to like teach people things. So it all these things on top of like my creative tendencies and my abilities as an actor, because you need to be a decent actor to be a casting director. Because if you're reading in the room with talent, you have to like give them something
yeah.
to work off of. Otherwise it's going to be a real difficult time casting.
Yeah.
So when you have all of that like perfect storm of just circumstance and ability and passion, it just kind of like makes sense. And I took the leap in 2011. After college, almost immediately, I was freelancing with, first with Erica Palgon, then with Liz Lewis again. And then one day out of the blue, Liz Lewis has this woman who is the managing manager of the company named Lynn Taylor. And she's from Texas. And she just called me out of the blue one day because they would like to have me come in freelance for a day here and there. And she was like, Kaylin, what are you doing on Tuesday? I was like, I'm free. I'm available to come in and work. How long do you think you'll need me for? Because it was like, you know, a few days at a time here and there. And she's like, how about every day after that? And I was like, I had that kind of reaction, as you yeah. just saw. And this was before Obamacare took effect. So effectively, once you graduated college, which I had 2 years ago, you are kicked off your parents' health insurance. So I was walking around without health insurance. And then right before I could even respond, she goes, oh, and by the way, we'll give you benefits.
Tick, all those things that you don't really get as an actor without a lot of groundwork. So,
and I was like, oh, can I call you back? And she was like, oh yeah, sure. Take all the time you need. And I hung up and I kind of screamed a little bit because I was actually driving my mom's car. I'm from Staten Island. So I was driving a car somewhere. And I was driving to one of my like day job gigs. I was a barista. I was driving there. So I had an emotional reaction, an excited one.
Yeah.
And then I called back and I was like, hi, Lynn, it's Caitlin. She goes, oh, wow, I was expecting for you to take more time with it. I was like, oh, no, I'll, yes. I didn't even eat things to ask about salary or hours or anything. I just said, yes. It was just like one of those things. Like, I'm a very instinctual person. Like if something in my gut says do it, then I'm going to do it. Like I've really honed that. And I know from talking to other older guard casting directors that that's really the thing that makes a good casting director is having like a strong connection with your gut instincts. Mm. You know,
is that from the perspective of knowing how you read and vibe whoever's coming into the room and just that gut on talent? But I guess with everything, right? Yeah, like the projects, the people.
I want to work on, the people who's right for what part, what to tell this person to get them to the performance I need them to have to sell them as this character. All of it. There's just a strong element of instinct and just like connection and vibe, that it's all very abstract. And if I was talking about it in any other terms to someone who didn't know the industry, they would probably think I was like into all like witchcraft and hooey, because it's not a tangible art form. It's not like a painter or a sculptor where you're working with a medium that someone who is a lay person to our world would be able to grasp or wrap their head around, you know? So trusting that same instinct, it felt right. It was like, this is where I'm supposed to be. This is what is supposed to be happening right now. And I'm signing up for this ride.
Gotcha. Did you feel, is that something that you always had as an instinct, or did you have to cultivate that over time? Because I'm always fascinated about whether that's like what the nature nurture argument of that whole thing is. I think we all have it, but I think for different people it's layered under like mounds of stuff. So for you, was that always there, or did you have to consciously tap into it?
No, it was always there. That was just always how I operated. And I think your opinion of that is much kinder than mine. I think it's something you can't teach, and I don't think everyone has it.
Okay.
You know, it's that argument against like book smarts and street smarts.
Sure.
Anyone can learn book smarts and academic, like, you know, there's a like a tangible method of how to learn that. To trust oneself is not a learned thing. You either do or you don't. And the only thing that is a remedy to that is age. You get older, and eventually, because you have no other choice, you have to develop some sense of trust with yourself. Otherwise, the world can be a much scarier place than it needs to be, you know?
Yeah, I think that was, yeah, I agree with that, though. I think that it is something that over time with age, you either face up to it a zillion times and decide to ignore it, or realize you have to kind of tap into that. And some people, I think, are just innately, naturally able to do that,
right?
You know, from out the womb. That's right. For a lot of others, it's just not second nature at all. But they can find ways to tap into it, but it's a lot more work and effort. So it's not an innate response. It's more labored.
Well, here's the thing. If you're doing it right, it's not work.
Sure.
Because that's the point. Because if you're doing work, then there's no trust there. The trust, it's an instinct. It's like breathing. Sure. It's like the first thing that comes to your mind, just go with that. And there are some people who intrinsically can't not overthink something. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. But they might not be very good at this particular job, but sure. they might be an excellent producer because they have to overthink the 10 different things that might go wrong on set to make sure that all the people like me and the director and the actors, that the project actually happens for us. So I don't think it's a bad thing or makes you a bad person. It just means you're not necessarily gonna find this job as rewarding or easy as someone who does operate more like myself. You know, it's just, you know, and it's different strokes for different folks, I guess you could say.
Totally.
Not to be super cliche, but it really is. Like, there are valid, important places in the world for people who don't do everything off of a gut decision. But I don't know many of the casting directors that I have grown close with to be those people.
Yeah, no, the running theme from you know, UK or US ones that I've spoken to is 9 times out of 10, the words essence and vibe and instinct, like they all same thing in a different kind of, you know, way, but it is the same thing that comes up. And you know, I think as actors, we intuitively know that it is this ethereal thing that we can't control. But we also really, especially, you know, when actors are starting out, you still kind of want to test the waters because you think you can, you know, because you want to figure it out. You want to figure out, like, what's the formula, but there isn't one. But how do I, you know, it's a tough one, especially for start actors that are starting, to get your head around. Because if you don't do a zillion auditions, you don't quite get that ethos of, like, I could do the best read in the world, but I'm just not it. That je ne sais quoi. Like, I'm not.
It's not even je ne sais quoi. Like, sometimes you could have the most amazing audition of your life, but it's a puzzle we're putting together to build sure. a specific world for a specific project. And you just might not live there. And that's okay. There might be something else where you do. But it's... In that kind of sense, I say, like, certain elements of being an actor, it's like winning a scratch off. You know what I mean? You have to keep spending not spending money, literally. I'm talking about
maybe too.
Right. But that's a whole nother conversation.
That is. We'll leave that for later.
Yeah. You know, you spend your dollar or $5 buying your scratch off every day. And eventually, if you do it enough, you'll win something. And usually it's the smaller little pieces, but if you get enough of those, then at the very least you can cover the cost of your lotto tickets you're buying. And at the very best, you're set for life. So, I mean, it's...
With that in mind, because obviously it's not a linear thing compared to many other lines of work.
Yes.
Sometimes it's made out to be like, well, get, you know, do 4 or 5 co-stars. Then you can get to guest. Then you get to series reg. And like, maybe I kind of get the framework. I understand it, but that just sounds far too primitive for the truth of what it actually is. And it doesn't account for all the gaps in between of, like, you know, what does it even take to get on the rung of like a co-star for someone. Sometimes that first one is harder than those thereafter, but it's not linear compared to working at a bank or whatever it might be. Like, I can't see that hierarchy.
No, if you're looking for a linear career progression, I have bad news for you.
Don't say it. Wrong
business.
Oh man.
Might be in the wrong business. It's not for the faint of heart.
And so my question kind of was, with that in mind, what's your view and opinion on, like, how actors can stay healthy creatively, but also maybe in some ways, just as if not more importantly, like, emotionally, and we can't discount it, like, financially, because if you don't have the money to live, I don't know about you, but I think starving artist is not the coolest thing to adhere to anymore. It's not quite like Picasso in Montmartre back in the day, even, you know, though we'd like it to be. So What's your view on all that? Because to me, that's more important in some ways than doing an on-camera class. Yes, technique is essential and you got to know it. But after a while, technique's technique. Like, how are you mentally approaching it?
You said a lot of smart things there.
Thank you.
And I'm just thinking of where to attack.
Where to start.
It's a lot to unpack. I really think that a way to negotiate in your mind as an actor, forward motion, bear with me here, it might sound hokey, and it's a little bit kind of like of my own interpretation of the artist's way, but I think a really important thing to your sanity is journal, mm-hmm. journaling. It's so funny. I just like during this pandemic and the free time I had, I was doing Marie Kondo of my house, and I found where I keep all my old acting journals. And what I would do is just to like, I was never growing up a person who could keep a journal. You know what I mean? It's just like not really good with commitment. Long term, which is why my job works for me, because you go from project to project. But I still love what I do, you know. I just knew the regular mundanity of an office was never gonna be my jam. Mm-hmm. But to give yourself the structure of forward motion, I believe that you need to write down in a journal, even if it's just bullet points, three things every day you did for your art. It can be anything. Three things every day. And then you find yourself, when you just start out writing those three things, writing a little bit more and more till you have like full journal entries. But it's like the gateway drug, like it's when your friend says, oh yeah, let's meet for a drink. And you never just like have just the one drink. Maybe that says more about me than it does. you always stay for at least two or three. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with journaling pages. And that way, if you're ever feeling really shitty about yourself and your life choices, you can take a journal from like a year ago or even 6 months ago and look at what your three things were then. And then mm-hmm. it puts into perspective how far you came. You know what I mean? Like, getting headshots and putting together your website or updating your resume, which seemed like a big deal last year, versus the agent you're working with now, it's like, oh wow. Yeah. And work begets work. So we're in this amazing era of technology that anyone with a smartphone and good lighting can make quality content that can make themselves fulfilled creatively, and also, you know, might help keep the party going. You know? There's a lot, there was a big holdup on paid work and actual acting work. So if anyone was working and making new content, it was people who could do it themselves. So I don't think that if you're truly invested in artistry and, you know, fulfilling that deep calling in your soul, that work you're going to make is going to be bad. I think that if you're truly coming from that genuine place and it feels true to you, if you just keep records, handwritten records of these things, it's a really intimate experience to handwriting things. I know Gen Zers and stuff might not understand same way.
What's writing? What's that? Cursive?
I can't even read cursive. That's so sad to me.
I might be totally making this up. I'm sure I heard or read in a clickbait article that they were stopping teaching cursive in some schools, or they were going. I've not made that up, have I?
Okay. No, it's true. That's why I said a lot of them can't read cursive.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
handwriting is a dying art.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's different. Like you say, it's different though. The tactile action of writing something pen to paper isn't the same as typing on a keyboard. I mean, the output is still output, but it feels different. And I don't know if there is science behind it, but I'm sure there must be some neural pathway that gets triggered in a different way by doing it physically and tangibly.
Well, the physical and tangible part of it is the artistry of it. It's the art of looking at your handwriting.
I don't know. You've not seen my handwriting, Kayla. I don't think we can call that artistry.
It truly is, though, because you can look back at something you physically wrote, and as a person, seeing how you wrote that can inform yourself so much about how you were feeling that day. If you wrote it really scribbly and quickly, if you took time and wrote it to like the nicest of your ability, if you were just like kind of doodling with it, like there's so many, it stimulates a sense memory to go back and reread handwriting versus typed stuff.
Sure.
I believe. And so I strongly advise that for your own growth and sanity, because it's so easy not to see the forest for the trees, and see how much farther things are in front of you, and forget to look back and see how far you've come.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And not many people have really spoken about that. A few have in different ways, but no one's really spoken about that. The gap forward is always going to be there, because there's always going to be something to go towards. And if you're growing, you're going to keep moving things forward for yourself as a target. But to your point, it's very easy to forget about looking back and seeing the small, like we're much better at looking at what other people have been doing and comparing ourselves to their journeys than our own individual
growth. You can't do that.
Growth. Yeah, we can't. Well, you can't. You can, but it's very easy to slip into.
I mean, you can't, as in you shouldn't do that. Everyone's able to do that. Like, just because you can doesn't mean you should. I'm a very firm believer in that for many applications, but especially this one. Hmm. You need to put blinders on in regards to comparing yourself, because there's only one you, and there's never going to be a replicated journey of any actor in this business. There might be similarities between a few, but there's never going to be an exact play-by-play that is done more than once. It's just not the nature of this business. It's ever evolving. The way we consume media is drastically different now than it was 5 months ago, you know?
Yeah.
So it's never going to be, you know, you can't make lightning strike twice. So it's more about focusing on your journey. And if this is something that you truly need to do to feed your soul, it's about reminding yourself of that journey, you know, because it's always going to look like an endless road if you're looking ahead. And if you look behind, after enough time passes and enough journal pages, it's like so cute. Some of the things, like 2008 Caitlin would write down as like wins for the day, you know. Not that they were small potatoes then, because at the time they seemed like big deals, but now it's like, oh my God, how much more has happened since then? It's literally a lifetime ago in my mind.
I love this because it is very much about the artistry. And I think it's very easy, and I'm sure we will get to that, you know, more business side of the discussion and sort of delve into that a little bit. But I do think, you know, you're talking about the journey and being in it for the long haul. And I think an artist is someone who will do this no matter what, but to find that expressive outlet is kind of up to the artist as well. A lot of times, not just waiting for the phone to ring from the agent, which
if you're waiting, you're never going to not be waiting. You know, energy cannot be created nor destroyed. So if you're just sitting and waiting, everything else around you is going to wait with you. You have to be creating your own momentum. And I can't say this enough, work begets work. Even the shittiest, smallest jobs, if you have no other job right now, you take the job, okay? Because work will beget more work.
But also to caveat that, based on what you said earlier, because I think actors hearing that might think, well, cool, but like no one's hiring me for a job. I'm not getting auditions to even get work. But we're talking also about just create your own stuff. You can make your own momentum, right? And that's the difference, to empower yourself to make your own air quotes work. And
your, yes.
Yeah.
Work when you're an artist isn't always
paid jobs.
Yeah, it's just not. It sucks, but that's the world we live in.
Sure.
Work is exercising your instrument, and you are your instrument. Okay? It's like when you have to go tune a cello. If you don't tune your cello and then you go to play it, it's going to sound like really bad if you haven't tuned it in like 6 months. You know, or you left it out of its case and in a humid room, it's going to warp and be like, ugh. So how do you expect to just sit and wait in not ideal circumstances to then suddenly have all your dreams come true and be amazing when a big opportunity just comes out of the blue?
Sure.
Like, you're not. You have to keep, it's a muscle, use it or lose it. You know what I mean? You have to constantly doing workouts. And here's one thing that like I stole from Bob Krakauer is, you know, when you're early on in your career, it is important as much as you can to take like good training, like classes from really good teachers. At a certain point though, that's not like long-term sustainable. So what you have to do is actively find like-minded actors in those classes and do a study group. The same way like you would do a study group if it were like a math class in college or an English class in college. And you guys get together and everyone brings sides from their recent auditions or just pull random sides off of ShowFacts or Sides Express and get together, you know, a couple of times a month, and you all film each other in audition framing and you watch back all the scenes and you discuss what each person did that worked and what they could do better. And that will train your eye of one, what to look for, and two, what you could be doing better. It sucks to watch yourself sometimes for some people. I was one of those people, but you'll never get better unless you watch yourself. Even if you're a theater person, the closest thing we have to an out-of-body experience to see what you're doing and what other people see. So to keep the party going, that's why I say find friends from an acting class, because then you're all going to speak the same vocabulary around your critiques and stuff and have like a common language there. And just like the more you do it, then, you know, that costs you nothing. You know what I mean? You might have to squeeze into someone's studio apartment because they have the biggest television, but you know what? Who cares? That's how, you know, so scrounge up enough money to take a couple of classes from like ongoing classes, not just a one-off, from like someone you really connect with their philosophy of acting. And just put yourself out there and make sure you get like phone numbers and emails of the people in your class and do it. Like I had this small like group of friends from my Bob Krakauer days when I was trying to be an actress, and we would do it all the time. And
well, I like it because you're talking about building your community, right? And building your tribe, yeah, or whatever you want to label it. And you know, sometimes
it's a collaborative art form. No one's an island.
Absolutely. I think it's easy to look at, you know, other actors as competition if you're naive about what this is starting out. But the reality is everybody kind of can grow up together and everybody's kind of in the same boat. And, you know, being proactive with your co-collaborators, and not just for like scene study, but then maybe that turns into a play that you can put on somewhere, or maybe it's a short film idea that you film and okay, maybe no one sees it, but maybe they do. And it's just, you get to work that muscle.
The work gets work element of it. You're doing scene work with people. And like you just gave three examples of how it could turn into actual jobs, you know?
Do you feel like actors being empowered to do that is something, it's always sort of been there, but do you feel like it's more prevalent now given the state of the world, given the easier access to technology as well? Like, do you feel there's been a shift towards that, or do you feel like it's always kind of been there and it's not maybe tapped into as much as it could or even should be still today?
The latter of that.
Okay, interesting.
I think not enough. Whenever I tell people that advice, they always look at me like I just like cracked like the secret of the universe for them, or like this like well-guarded secret or insider knowledge. It's like, this isn't like really, I didn't come up with this by myself. People have done this before and it worked. You know, it's, there are things you can do to get yourself started with what you can afford, you know, and then just, you know, get your money's worth, you know, keep using those tools with people who are using the same tools. And it really is about the community. Like, if you look at some of the old, like I like to think of it like, you know, the stand-up and the comedy communities and improv comedy communities, those are like tribes, the way that they act. Like, it's not just important to go up and do your set. You have to stick around and conversate and congregate after. And those are your contemporaries. And there are very few opportunities in film and television for one man and one woman shows. So you kind of have to get good at working with people, because when you book these jobs, you're spending insane amounts of very intimate, raw, emotional, vulnerable time with these people. So going into it with a rapport and the practice of doing that regularly with this all different types of people is really like, you know, learning new riffs if you were playing an instrument. It's helping your growth. It's preparing you for, like, these are your coworkers, you know, and you're all working for the same team. You know, if you look at people like competition, it means, in my mind, that you think very little of your talent and your individuality, because no one's really anyone else's competition. You know, I mean, yes, you might be reading for the same role, but it's not like anyone's ever competing. The person who's right for the role is the one who usually gets it. Aside from like famous extemporaneous circumstances, like they know the director or whatever, but that's a whole nother conversation. But when we're talking about people who are auditioning for roles, and then that they get cast for roles from that audition, it's to look at people as competition is creating extra hurdles in your mind that just end up stunting your growth, you know? Like,
it's an easy cop out too, because you're kind of, you know, not taking accountability for your own artistry and your own life. And
it's an excuse. It's a really good excuse to make and tell yourself that will invariably just make you bitter. And if you're bitter, you're not going to be as generous of spirit. Generosity of spirit is the key to good acting. Because you have to not just be acting when it's your lines, you have to be reacting in a scene. You have to be the sounding board for the other actor's vulnerability, and it's a give and take. You know what I mean? It's like, It's like
but you can't explain it. That's the thing. It is. It's kind of. It's what you're doing. It's that intangible. It's an energy dance, kind of. You know, you have to be able to.
Yes, it's an energy dance, and it's like think of people who are ballroom dancing. A shitty partner is gonna make their partner look shitty. You know, and sure. If you're being the best partner you can be, you're gonna make your scene partner look good. And then that's a reciprocal thing, because then when they look good, you look good. And, you know, it's about thinking about things bigger than yourself.
Ooh, don't be saying that now, Kaylin. Careful.
I know it's really hard for a lot of actors to think outside themselves, because invariably a lot of people who want to go into an industry where you have very little privacy and are in front of cameras all the time tend to have narcissistic qualities. But it's necessary.
Sure. I think when you're the product, as you know, you often hear, there is that difficulty to learn how to detach and to see things from sort of a more objective point of view, which I think is important, not just with your work, but also with, like, you know, if we talk about headshots and showreels and materials, like how you pick the right thing is very difficult when you are the thing. So there is that element always of being so close to it. But then I suppose it is that counterintuitive aspect that the best performers that we do see 9 times out of 10 have somehow in some way in their own life been able to sort of step away from that a little bit and just, I didn't want to say let it go, but I'm going to have to say let it go. Let it go and breathe into it.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't even think it's so much as letting it go. It's trusting the process.
There's a lot to that, though. Can you unpack that a little bit? Because I think, again, that's something actors hear all the time. And outside of actors, like any line of work, you hear that a lot. What is that, at least to you, what does that mean?
Trusting the process means understanding that your life is not a treadmill. Even if you think you're not going somewhere, you inevitably and invariably are. And if you put in the work that we were talking about, like if you get your scene study group going, if you start making shorts with friends from that scene study group, if you're submitting yourself every single day, if you don't have an agent, and even when you do have an agent, until you're getting scripts by the pile on your desk, you should be actively submitting yourself on top of your agent submitting you. Like doing things every day add up. Okay. If you take 3 steps a day in 30 days, you took 90 steps. 90 steps, you're like already halfway down the block. You're always going somewhere, even if you can't see the destination. Okay. And if this is what you really want, you have to get really comfortable with being uncomfortable. Because if that's not something you can live with, find another path, because that is what you have to live with. That is the reality of this business. And anyone who's already made it would probably say some variation of the same. You know, very rarely did it just happen to someone or just fell into their lap. There's so much behind the success of other actors that the people who make it look the most easy usually have done the most work on themselves.
It's interesting. Have you read or heard of Matthew McConaughey's new book he's come out with, Green Lights? He's like doing a Zoom tour at the moment, pitching it everywhere. And it's kind of, it's touching on a lot of the things you've been talking about in the last 10 minutes or so. So he basically took a bunch of his memoirs and acting journals, literally what you're talking about, from before he even left Texas and went to LA. And he's used that to create this book. And it's talking about his anecdotes and stories of, you know, different experiences and how he's navigated his way through life and the industry being a part of that. And I think one key thing he seems to keep talking about in some of these interviews is a period where he left LA and then came back. And when he came back, the need for the job, the need to be seen, he said he needed an agent, but he didn't go for one. And then when he came back, he realized, well, I need to get one now, but I'm not chasing after it with that energy that I was using before. Again, that sounds so ethereal because it's hard to just, you can't just orchestrate that on the drop of a dime, or maybe you can, but he speaks to, you know, this more intangible approach where it's knowing yourself, being in touch with yourself, having that own awareness to then not be so desperate and clingy for what the industry could give you.
I mean, desperate and clingy is kind of like
very appealing
artistry, really. I mean, if you are ever at a point in your career that you're not worried that you might never act again, then you should probably quit. Because the thought of never acting again is what drives even Academy Award winners. If you watch those Hollywood Reporter roundtables, literal Academy Award winners will say on a regular basis that they are afraid about the day that the phone will stop ringing. Literal Oscar winners.
Sure, but
they'll worry about
fear that. And desperation are slightly different energies though, right? Aren't they, right?
But here's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about what Martha Graham called the blessed unrest.
Okay.
It's always about the need to keep creating and worrying about the day, not that you won't get a job because you need the money, but you won't ever get to act again.
100%.
That is a sentence worse than death for anyone who truly belongs in this profession.
100%.
And that is what I mean when I say the day you stop worrying if the phone stops ringing, if this is my last chance to act today, ever, then it's time to quit.
Sure.
Because the need, like once you can be satiated emotionally by something else, that this isn't all of it for you, you're probably done. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. Like, it means emotionally there is something else fulfilling you. But the people who make it all the way have such a deeply emotional connection to their work that it would be punishment to never get to do it again for the rest of their lives. And that's necessary because there is a lot of emotional gymnastics you have to do to be a working actor who's not famous. It's really what it is, you know? So if you don't have that insatiable drive, you're going to burn out and you're going to become bitter and you're going to start to resent the people around you and you're going to become really miserable and it's just going to be a downward spiral. It's that fire in your belly that is what makes it all worth it. And I 100% know that that is something that drives even the most famous of actors. So it's something to grow comfortable with being uncomfortable, like I said earlier. You need to embrace those fears because that allows you and forces you to be as present as possible at every small modicum opportunity you have to act. You know, that is the thing the it factor people talk about. It's that grabbing energy that someone brings to a performance when this is life or death for them in every situation. And it creates a power behind a performance that is undeniable. And I really think that if you don't have that, it's when you're like, all right, well, that reading was good, but you probably might not book it. You know what I mean? It's there's like this gripping connection. And I think that like, this goes back to the bigger question you said when we started this part of the conversation, it's like, you know, how do you mentally stay okay with the bullshit day jobs and the countless auditions that don't lead to bookings and stuff like that? It's keeping that fire alive is how you stay okay. Yeah. Because it's what keeps you going. You know, it's the gas in the engine.
And now more than ever, there's more opportunities or chances to do that. Even amidst COVID and lockdown and all that, there is still with tech. I mean, this is case in point. People jump on Zoom, do reading over Zoom, improvise with what's available in the situations we're in and make stuff because you just kind of have to. And it's an expression. And I think taking a little bit of judgment away of what it looks like or it needing to be this sort of perfect end result that's all singing, dancing, and glossy helps to not cripple you from even starting. Because I think that can be like in any business, you know, a lot of startup businesses, they sometimes want to be, you know, able to launch it 100% and they never get anywhere because they have.
If you're a startup though, you're just by definition not starting at 100%. You're starting up.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So it's about bootstrapping it and doing what you can with what you have.
Yeah.
And then as people start buying that, you know, taking what you have and reinvesting it into the company.
Yeah. Refine, test, learn, and just keep iterating. That's a word I didn't think I'd say today. Cool. Let's, if we can, before, because I'm mindful of your time, just maybe talk a little bit about your views on technicalities around auditioning in this newer world that we're in, right? You spoke a little bit about how you've been doing some commercial auditions. I assume it's all either over Zoom or self-tapes or something like Zoom.
I've been using Zoom so far because they're still working out the kinks on how many people can be in the room on other platforms. So like if I'm doing a live audition remotely, it's because there's a director or a producer or somebody there.
Sure. And for you personally, like how have you personally found it and what's your take? Do you like it? Do you still think it's sort of a learning phase with it?
I mean, I am pretty tech savvy, relatively speaking. And there's perks, I get it. Which is, you know, you don't have to leave your house. That's a big one for people. You're in your safe space.
Yeah.
So whatever anxieties people extrapolate in their mind about what it means to be in the audition room can melt away. The thing that I don't love is that we're asking you to, for free, become a producer, a director of photography, a gaffer, a sound designer, and all of it just to audition. And I think that's unfair because it creates cost prohibited elements for a lot of people. Even though there are economical ways to make stuff look good, you know, I think it gives people who happen to be more tech savvy or have better equipment become like front runners and stuff just by default because of literal technicalities. And that I think is unfortunate because the playing field isn't as level. You know, when you're coming into audition into my space where I make everything look beautiful and the lighting on you will always be perfect and we will hear every word that you're saying, it is, the playing field is level. It's truly just about your performance.
Sure.
But there's so many more moving parts to this remote auditioning. The plus is we can have a session and you can be anywhere in the country auditioning. So, I mean, there's that.
Sure.
Or in the world, really, as long as you have a good Wi-Fi connection.
But yeah, you're right. It's a lot of extra stuff for the actor on top of just being able to be creative and know the lines and then be able to be present and give that performance that you're already, you know, with a self-tape, you were just in your head about uploading it on time and compressing the file. Now it's like, is my sound working? Is my camera on? Is it too dark? Is it not dark? Am I close enough? Who else is in the room? I can't see everybody, but there's more people here. So there's a, you know, it's a learning curve, I guess, from an actor's side as well to treat it, because it's not like a self-tape. I mean, I guess that was going to be my next question. Do you see them as almost one and the same, or do you see them as totally different in terms of the approach?
I mean, I feel like there's more similarities between the two than differences.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that the big stark difference is it really is dictated by your internet connection.
Okay.
A good internet connection is another thing that can also be extremely cost prohibitive. So I feel like it throws a lot of cost factors and barriers to entry for people just by design. But until, you know, the world resumes as to business as usual, which who knows how long that will take, it's the best we've got right now.
Sure.
It's a necessary evil.
Sure.
You know, I love the book by Michael Shurtleff called Audition. And he was like, the reason why we have to get good at auditioning as actors is because no one's figured out a better way to cast things. So no one's figured out a better way to do remote casting. So we're just going to have to get good at what's available to us.
Sure. And to be fair, I mean, let's be real. Like, even if it was 4 or 5 years ago, without it, we wouldn't be able to do even half as much as what we're doing now. So, it's helped people stay connected and get things moving and going a little bit and somehow help people to a degree feel a little bit more connected and sane.
Right. And, but you know what also, like, YouTube has become like what Google was 10 years ago. Anything you need to know how to do, you type it into YouTube and there is a video that's high quality and clear explaining to you how to do the thing. So you want to make your footage look good without spending $1 million. There's at least 10 videos on YouTube showing you how to do that. I know, I've checked and I've looked. And when I send out self-tape requests, I link to one specifically that explains to people how to get good lighting without necessarily purchasing lights if you can't afford to. Like right now, I'm sitting in front of a specific window in my house during this time of day because I know I don't have to worry about setting my lighting up. I'm a casting director, so I own lights.
Sure.
But if I don't have to set them up, I don't want to.
Sure. Yeah, no, but that's totally fair. And natural light normally is going to be better anyway, if you can get that front on view. Yeah, you're right. Google, I always bring this up on the show. People think I'm going to get affiliate links and like get money for it. I don't. But have you heard of Yuval Noah Harari? You will have probably heard of Sapiens. No, you've not heard the book Sapiens?
Mm-mm.
No?
Mm-mm.
Oh, check him out. The guy's called Yuval Noah Harari. He's done 3 books. Mm-hmm. The first one, like, he talks about the origin of humans and the stories we tell ourselves is you know, groups and how that's evolved over time. And then some of his later ones talk about tech and the way that we might live our lives in the future or in the present. I did have a point to that based on something you said, and I've totally forgotten what it was, but check out his book. That's annoying. It'll come to me later. Anyway, books aside, it's been great chatting to you about all things casting and a few maybe more mindset-y things too, which is always cool to delve into. When I finish these, I like to wrap them up with 10 little quick fire questions. Your eyes have widened. As all good artists do, I've stolen them because that's what we do. Straight from James Lipton and Inside the Actor's Studio. So Really? Oh, wow.
When I was waitressing at Cipriani's, he was at the Wall Street 2 Money Never Sleeps premiere.
Okay.
And I waited on him, and he was one of the rudest people I have ever had the displeasure of waiting on.
Huh. Definitely doesn't give that facade, at least on the show.
I've heard maybe outside of that he was not a nice person, but I've experienced it, and I think it's more valid of an experience because I am truly a believer that how you treat waitstaff is the most telling thing about a person's personality and who they are as a human being is how they treat waitstaff.
Agreed.
He didn't treat them very well.
Wow. There you go. Well, I mean, I've stolen his questions, so it's not.
That's okay. He was a great interviewer, kind of a jerk, though.
Just not a great person to serve. Well, there you go.
Not nice to his waiters and waitresses. Okay, but what are the questions?
The first question is, what's your favorite word? Is it James Lipton? Is that your favorite word?
No, it's not. My favorite word. I thought about it. I really love words, though, so this is tough. I'm like drawing a blank right now.
What's your favorite word right now, then, to take the pressure off a little bit so it's not like forever in perpetuity and just something that comes to mind right now?
I'm trying to think maybe like a word that I say all the time. Okay, I think just because it just came into my head, and it's very New York and on brand for what we were talking about since this whole thing, is I, being a lifelong New Yorker, there's the yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that is something that I
say a lot.
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time. It is, you can't just say it once. You have to say it. It comes in threes, and it is an affirmative to like acknowledge to the person you're talking to that, yes, I hear you, I'm listening to you, and I am in some level agreeing with you. So that's what each yeah represents.
Multiple threes has different things. I like it.
Yeah. Each means something different, and it's almost like, are you even really listening if you don't say it?
Mental note, next time I'm in New York, just so I make sure I pass the tests. What's your least favorite word?
Least favorite word. I'm sorry.
In every context?
Pretty much. I don't like the word sorry.
Okay.
Because unless you have physically impaled someone, it's kind of pointless. Like, you can't put toothpaste back in the tube, and even if you feel bad about it, it doesn't fix anything. It's kind of like just like virtue signaling. It is literally the origin story for virtue signaling, is apologizing. I think, you know, everything is a learning experience, and you take things as such, And like I said, unless there's someone specifically hurt in a situation, it almost is a cop out, and it prevents growth.
I like that. I hadn't thought about it that way, but it makes, I mean, impaling aside, which is only a weekly event anyway, where I'm from. So it's fine. It's all good.
Exactly.
Next question is, what turns you on in a creative kind of way?
What turns me on? Good writing.
Mm-hmm.
The art of conversation.
What's that? That died a long time ago, didn't it?
I feel like we've been doing it all day here, like right now. Yeah. So like a good conversation. Someone who asks smart questions. Asking questions drives the creative juices. When you stop asking questions, you stop moving.
You've settled, basically.
Well, no, you're just like dead.
Or settled, dead. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's like
you're stagnant. You are. You're not moving forward.
Right. It's the opposite of forward motion.
So rigor mortis. Okay. It's rigor mortis is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
What turns you off then, the flip of that question?
Assholes. It's a word I've invented. When someone's an asshole, it's when they ask a question and you give a well thought answer and they weren't actually asking you a question. They were floating an idea by you with every intention of doing what they originally were going to do anyway, and were hoping you were going to validate that choice for them. And if you don't, you just gave them a really thoughtful, meaningful answer that is falling on deaf ears. Okay. So it's like, you weren't really asking me that question. You're going to go do what you're going to do anyway. You were just hoping I would agree with you. So you literally just wasted my time. I think it's the most rude thing you can do to anyone, is waste their time asking a seemingly genuine question only to not receive the answer. That drives me nuts.
I can tell.
Especially in an audition room. If I give you direction.
Okay. Yeah.
It's because I know more about what they want this role to be than you do right now. And disagreeing with me does not make you a stronger actor. It makes you an asshole.
Yeah, no, but that's interesting. And especially, you know, that you brought it to, you know, the topic of this, you know, whole show, which is acting and casting. I mean, I guess it's great to come in and have the actor's point of view and let them do their take. But then if you can't take direction, it's one thing. But if you fight the direction, like that's the asshole territory.
I can't send you to set like that. It reflects poorly on me. Sure. So
yeah. Which is, you know, it's another good point, because people don't think about that, because, you know, narcissistic actors, but it's a reflection of everybody, and the collaboration does obviously feedback on you guys too. And you're going to bat for the people you bring into the room, and especially the people that end up getting the job. So, you know, you're putting every consideration into, I guess, yes, obviously performance, but probably just as much, if not equally, what are they like as a person?
It says volumes about who you are as a person.
Sure. Well, I'm going to borrow the word asshole from you, just to help spread it. Is it on Urban Dictionary? Because I feel like you should definitely get it up there and claim it if it isn't.
I don't know if it is.
Oh, you got to check.
It should be. An asshole.
It should be. Ask
the question only in hopes that you're going to hear the answer that you wanted to hear.
I'm going to check later, and if it's not, I'll let you know so you can get on that, because I feel like you should flag in the sand, own it. Next question is optional, because people don't necessarily always want to curse. I don't really care. But the question is, what is your favorite swear word?
That's a tough one.
Or most used, maybe.
In my everyday life, I don't swear a ton unless I have like stubbed my toe or something really egregious happens unexpectedly. I think it's a tie between shit and son of a bitch.
Both are strong. I also thank you for not saying fuck, because that's what most people say. And I think, yeah. What's multi-uses? I think that's a thing. It's easy and it's kind of got different uses and people can kind of.
The thing is with fuck.
Let's talk about it. I feel like this is going to be.
I was always a grammar and language nerd growing up, and I very much am cognizant of the origin of words and expressions. And to fuck is to fornicate or to have sex or to make love or whatever they people want to call it, and using it in a negative sense never really made sense to me. It's like, how is that expressing your anger? Like, I don't under, just because it's a bad word, I don't know. Where shit, it's like
not pleasant.
Poop, it's like something not good. Son of a bitch.
I love that you gave a synonym for shit there, by the way, too, just for anyone who didn't quite know that it is also poop.
We've established it's like a literal bad thing. Mm-hmm. I am saying it because I am irate or very, very instantly mad. And I want to associate this feeling with something bad and gross and undesirable. So for me to say fuck, it's just like, I think people just like the sex appeal and the sexiness of saying it. But in practice, it just doesn't roll off the tongue for me the same way. And it's kind of like, why would you paint that picture in a negative light? Says a lot about
a lot about everybody. Well, now you've put it that way, though, and you've clearly given it some thought. I'm like, oh damn, oh, yeah. I think I should retire that jersey and put it on the wall and leave that word alone too. Because
right. It's like, but what's so bad about it? Like, why is that the thing you yell in anger? Like, you know, it really is like, oh, I really like asshole too. In the same, it's in the same, I think, like section of the store as shit too.
Yes. I didn't know we'd walked into Walmart, but
something clearly. Yeah, if someone's an asshole, yeah.
Yep. Yep. Strong.
That's a one I like. Yeah. Those are things that I feel like I associate cursing usually with
unpleasant, not nice stuff.
Displeasantries. So yeah.
All of those work. This has been one of my favorite answers to this particular question as well, because it's been thought out.
Yes.
Normally it's not thought out. Normally it's reactive. And I think that you kind of had the sort of energetic impulse reaction, but also it was substantiated. And so I think that I thank you for that. The next question is, what's your favorite sound or noise?
Sound or noise. Do you hear the ambience in the background?
Is it that?
Yeah.
Just the sound of, specifically in New York or just generally?
Yes, of New York? The sound of, so it's this weird sound of traffic in the far distance, because I live a couple avenues over from the West Side Highway, and the fan going in my apartment, and like I think it's just like city ambiance, like an urban ambiance is the best way to explain it. If I am traveling and I'm in a place that is genuinely quiet at night, I get spooked and have a very difficult time falling asleep. Like, I've lived in New York City my entire life. We grew up in front of a bus stop that we would hear going to sleep every night as kids. It's like something about passing buses and distant traffic. It's like soothing to me. It's like when people have, you know, like those white noise machines. That would be my white noise.
Sure. It's interesting, isn't it? It's interesting, like, just our upbringings and what we've been around from a young age and what we've grown up around and how that just formulates the things that we're drawn to still in adult life. But it makes total sense. It makes total sense.
I think I found my favorite word, though, cacophony.
The cacophony of the ambient sound?
Cacophony of urban life.
See, now you're just showing off because you're amalgamating questions together with your answers too. See, this is the next person that comes on the show is going to have the bars being raised. The next question is the flip, really. It's, what's your least favorite sound or noise?
Oh my God. The sound that grosses me out is...
not sure what your hands are doing right now. I'm getting a bit concerned.
It's the, like, when someone scratches, like, on top of their socks.
Right. Well, like nails on the fabric kind of thing, or?
That drives me crazy. Like nails against, like,
a fabric. Like fabric.
Like the, specifically someone scratching on top of fabric, that weird, like, sound it makes.
Okay, so for anyone who ever gets back into a casting room, make sure that they scratch their sweater or whatever before they come in and meet you, because
they come in, yeah. Or just don't wear the scratchy sweater
either.
Yeah.
Either. Yeah. Getting there now. Last few questions. The next one is, what job other than your own or ones you already done would you most like to attempt?
Attempt, like in real life, like project jobs, or are we talking about professions?
Oh no, like professions, like careers. What other careers? Like
if I wasn't a casting
director. Like if you weren't in casting and you know, you weren't an actress or anything like that, what would you?
Okay, so if I wasn't in the business, I was gonna go into psychology.
Gonna
be a clinical psychologist, because I do think there's a similar
overlap
between casting directors and audition rooms and therapists in their offices. So that's going to be my path.
Gotcha. And what career or profession would you never want to attempt?
Really, I never thought about that. I would never want to be an accountant.
Mm.
That seems
fun.
So tragically boring.
But bless them for doing it. If anyone is an accountant,
for the people who do it and they love their job, more power to them. But to me, that would be a job that genuinely feels like punishment.
It's the opposite of the creative.
There's absolutely nothing creative about doing other people's taxes.
Unless you're cooking the books, then it's a bit creative. But that aside,
if you're being creative as an accountant, it's a federal crime. So I'm
going to label the episode that, by the way. That's what this episode is going to be called.
I love it. Yes. That's a no-go for me.
Gotcha. Totally makes sense. Final question, a little bit more of an ethereal one, but it is, when it's all said and done, what would you like the story of your life to be? What kind of legacy would you like to leave? And your face totally dropped as I asked that question.
Legacy. I want the the legacy for me, I want to be is continuing the work that the original three casting directors who founded the CSA set out to do. I want my legacy to be solidifying the Oscar for casting directors. That was the reason they started the CSA, was to solidify and get the long overdue Oscar for our profession. And I would like my legacy to involve bringing the profession of casting to a mainstream audience so that they know not only what we do, but who we are, how it is integral to the media you consume every day, and just celebrating the art form. I want to make this is the big one though. I want every child in the world growing up to be able to look at a screen or an image and see a reflection of themselves somewhere in the world. No matter what you look like or who you are or what your life experience is, I want you to be able to have a reflection of yourself that is accurate and inspirational in the ether. I think as white people, we don't step outside our own experience enough and take for granted that almost every TV show has at least half a dozen people that look like you and I. And I literally get emotional thinking about these YouTube videos you see of children who are Asian or African American or Black or Latinx seeing a character that resembles them for the first time. There was this like video shared on Twitter of this little Asian girl seeing Philippa Sue in Hamilton on Disney Plus going, "Mommy, it's me, it's me." And I lost it. I was like, no little girl should have to wait till they're like five to have that moment. That shouldn't be a significant special moment. That should just be a thing.
Sure.
And that is what I want my legacy to be.
Amazing. I like that. And like with every kind of answer you've given, it's clearly not off the cuff and very much well thought out and comes from an intentional place of you know, who you are and what you're about. And I think that that speaks volumes. Kaylin, it's been a lot of fun chatting to you about all the different stuff we weaved into different places. But I found it really fascinating.
Done already. Oh my God, the time flew.
I know, right? Listen, final moments over to you, really, if you want to let people know where they can connect with you if they want to on the socials. And I guess if you don't mind, a takeaway for you, like what would be the thing if you were going to button this conversation up that you'd want anyone listening or watching to maybe take away as the resounding point of view, I guess.
Okay.
No pressure.
On socials, you can find me on as Caitlin D. Jones, and then CDJ Casting is more like, you know, stuff I'm casting that I'll post about. And also for a takeaway, I would like people to take away that casting directors are just people. So when you go into a room, if you're auditioning for me or someone legendary like Bernie or Tara or Richard or Alexa, or I'm saying a lot of New York people, but it's because of where I live, or myself, they're just humans. They're just like people. And we're not the boogeyman. We are all just trying to do a job that is to make sure you look good. We want you to book it, no matter who you are. We want every single person walking in the room to be the one who's going to book it, because then we did a good job. So I think the scariest part of auditioning is who's in the room with you. And the minute you acknowledge that whoever it is in the room with you is a human and a person who's just like regular, who has like embarrassing habits and, you know, awkward family photos and all that stuff like you and I, the more you can invest that same energy into making your audition the best performance you can be. So I think if you take nothing else away from this, it's casting directors are people too, and we're here to help you.
Thanks for tuning into this episode with casting director Caitlin D. Jones, whose key message was really all about owning your own artistry and focusing on your journey, on how far you've come, and really taking the power back into your own hands. Coming up next on the show, I have two-time Emmy Award-winning casting director Debbie Manwiller, who's known for such shows as 24 and The Blacklist. So until then, stay well, and I'll catch you next time.